Well, first of all, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Please sit comfortably and feel free to move around to keep yourself comfortable. I'd like to begin by thanking Kate for that very warm introduction, and to both Kate and Michael for this invitation. I'm very pleased to be back here again. It feels very much at home, so thank you. Can everyone hear me in the back? If a problem develops, because sometimes I can, you know, just let me know, raise your hand, or give me some signal, and I'll try to speak up a little bit more. Yeah. Let me take advantage of the tea while I can. In order to talk about what Buddhism has to offer that can help us understand and respond to the ecological crisis, and also turning that around, what the ecological crisis implies about how we have been understanding and how we should be practicing Buddhism today, kind of my two main concerns here, I'd like to talk about two icebergs. These aren't real icebergs, they're metaphors, taking advantage of the fact that icebergs, as we know, are mostly submerged. It's only about one-fifth of the iceberg that we see above the surface. And therefore representing the fact that a lot of the issues here are maybe submerged, unconscious things that we're normally not aware of. The first iceberg is our situation today, our whole situation. And at the very top, of course, is what we call climate change. And that is such a bland term, right? No, it's not climate change. It's not even global warming. Some people talk about global heating. Others are talking about climate emergency. And I think that's maybe a better term. We're all familiar with it. I'm not going to waste our time going into details. Let me just make three quick points. Number one, it does seem to be the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced. That's pretty big. Number two, we're doing it to ourselves. Quite striking. We're not talking about an asteroid or volcanoes. I mean, imagine how we would respond if alien spaceships appeared and started pumping methane or other forms of carbon. I mean, how quickly we would unite together to fight against them. It'd make a great movie, right? But the fact that we're doing it to ourselves really complicates things. That's why we can't sort of get it together. And of course, part of the problem is some people are a lot more responsible than others, and some people are benefiting from the present situation a lot more than others. So that makes it very difficult, yeah? And the third quick point is, although what we are doing collectively in response is not negligible, nonetheless, it's clearly not enough. It's just not enough. I think that's probably something most of us here could agree on. But here's my first big point. What I've just said about those three characteristics, they apply not just to the climate emergency, to a much greater ecological emergency. That's why it's the tip, just the tip of the iceberg. Below that tip, but still above the surface, is the ecological crisis, which includes an awful lot more. And of course, it's all interconnected. I mean, if we just consider the oceans, the oceans are warming up. In fact, the oceans up to this point have absorbed about, well over 90% of the excess heat that has been produced over the last century. If the oceans weren't there, we would all be literally toast, right? something like that. I think the temperature would have gone up 90-some degrees Fahrenheit. So we probably wouldn't be here. we're at, in the process, they're absorbing carbon. It's acidifying the ocean, making it difficult for corals as well, and also phytoplankton and such at the core of the, you know, food chain. So yeah, the climate change is causing lots of problems for the oceans. But hey, let's not blame it all in, did I really say climate change? The climate emergency is causing all these problems, but fishing, you know, basically all of the major fishing grounds are totally exploited or overfished. In fact, it's predicted that the oceans will be pretty much fished out by 2048. And what about plastics? I mean, it's quite amazing to me that commercial plastics began pretty much around the time that I was born. Okay, I've been around for a while, but it's one generation. And now they're inescapable. They're everywhere. They're on every meter of the ocean floor, even in the deepest trenches. Yeah? They're in most of our drinking water. In Rocky Mountains, we just learned, they're in the air. They break down, and the truth is, all of us here, we have lots of tiny plastic particles in our bodies, and we don't really know what they do. And we can go on and on and on. Topsoil, in the last 100 years, half of all agricultural topsoil has eroded away. And maybe most significant from particularly a Buddhist standpoint, from a tradition where we take vows to save all sentient beings, we're well into the sixth great extinction event, where species are being destroyed. You know, you get different estimates, 100 to 1,000 times or even 10,000 times faster, species are going extinct. Faster than the than they normally would. A couple days ago, I read a critique of this term extinction event. It's too neutral. It's a bit like carbon warming or global warming. Let's not call it an extinction event. Let's call it the first great extermination event. It's not as though it's just happening. Let's be honest, we're doing it. One species is responsible for that, right? So putting all this together and all kinds of other things, we could talk about the different toxins in the water, in the air, in the earth, in our bodies. We could go on and on and on, but I think you get the point. I don't want to waste our time here. But what this means, of course, is that what we're faced with now is something much more than the challenge of just converting as quickly as possible from fossil fuels to renewables, in which case we could just kind of go on as we have been. No, it's something much bigger. It really seems to go to the heart and to the meaning of our civilization. We are a civilization that's lost its way. What does that mean? What does that mean for us as individuals, for our species, and for us as Zen practitioners? We could say that our collective preoccupation with never-ending economic growth and consumerism, which frankly, in a way, you could say it's the meaning of our civilization. Right? Consumerism as the new religion, really. The main way that most people try to find happiness. Again, if those alien spaceships were observing us and they didn't listen to what we said, they didn't maybe understand our language, but they just observed what we as a species were doing, what would they conclude about what our ultimate values are? From a Buddhist perspective, many things could be said about this fixation on growth, why it is that it can't provide the satisfaction we seek. But in order to understand the relationship between this top part that we see of the iceberg and what's going on below with the submerged parts, how the ecological crisis is a symptom of something even more problematical, I want to look at one particular example of overfishing. talk about bluefin tuna. I'm sure you all know that Japanese people love sushi, and by far the most favorite form of sushi involves bluefin tuna. Unfortunately, bluefin tuna also happens to be one of the world's most endangered fish. But some Japanese corporations, including Mitsubishi, the Mitsubishi conglomerate, they've figured out a very interesting response. I mean, there are limits set on how much bluefin tuna. There are national agreements, but they've been buying as much as they can, and also sometimes illegally. It's not clear to me if they have their own trawlers or they just buy up. But they have been basically buying as much bluefin tuna as they can, well beyond the official limits, and bringing them back to Japan and storing them, freezing them in huge freezers near Tokyo, knowing that as bluefin tuna becomes more endangered and even commercially extinct, the value of their bluefin tuna will go up even more. The irony, of course, is the fact one of the main things that's making it go extinct is what they are doing. So it's this weird kind of, right? I'm assuming most of you are going to react like I am, that there's something immoral, obscene about this. And yet, in economic terms, it makes a lot of sense, because if Mitsubishi doesn't do it, probably somebody else will. This is an extreme example of a kind of fundamental problem here, but it's not really that unusual. I think it reveals a kind of fundamental perversity built into economic systems motivated by profit. That is to say, they can't help but see the natural world as a means to some other end. The natural world, including bluefin tuna, etc., are a means to an end. That's their value. We usually take that relationship for granted, but it becomes more questionable. What I really want to do here is point to a kind of an irony. I guess that's the best term for it. When we remember that profit refers to money, and money ultimately is just a kind of a social agreement, right? Those bills in your pocket or those numbers in your bank account, in and of themselves, they have no value whatsoever, right? But we have defined them. We have made them into the most valuable thing of all because we can exchange them for almost anything. We have the social agreement. It's a social construct. It's our medium of exchange. So we can use money to buy almost anything we desire, and because obtaining almost everything we desire is on an unreflective level a kind of definition of happiness, I think part of the issue with money is that it comes to symbolize happiness for us. Even for people who have more than they need, right? I mean, the story of, what did I hear yesterday? Somebody said, once you have more than $50 million, it's really hard to figure out what to do with your money, right? Well, most of us would like to have the chance to try, but there's a point here, especially when you realize that there's lots of billionaires who have much more than that, and they're still focused on getting more. What's going on there, right? It's not just satisfying your desires. There's some symbolic value here that people are caught up in here, right? A symbolic value that often overshadows our appreciation of the natural world. What I'm pointing to is this paradox, this irony, that we have become preoccupied with destroying real wealth. By real wealth, I mean oceans flourishing with all kinds of sea life, healthy forests, lakes, rivers, mountains, and so forth, in order to maximize numbers in bank accounts. But remember, money is in itself a nothing. So what that really becomes, we are collectively sacrificing everything really valuable in order to maximize something that in and of itself has no value whatsoever. Does that make sense? And yet, in another way, it doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, but that's a way of kind of showing what's at the root of the ecological crisis here. I think this points to why the whole eco-crisis is really the most urgent symptom of a larger emergency revealing the predicament of our civilization, whose foremost preoccupation in indefinite economic growth, and we could add technological development, this preoccupation is really, I think, incompatible with fundamental Buddhist values. And how this preoccupation with growth inevitably, sooner or later, is going to bump up against the limits of the biosphere because the Earth isn't growing. And can we say that that's the situation we find ourselves in now? And therefore, I think today it's not enough for us just to focus on meditation, on our own awakening and so forth, but we really have to reflect deeply, contemplate what this situation means for us, for our descendants, for our practice, and for what Buddhism is going to become in the future, in this now globalized civilization that we have. Okay. A lot of Buddhist teachings are relevant here, as I said, and I guess I just want to mention interdependence and non-duality. You know, one of the fascinating things about the ecological crisis is it challenges the fragmentation, or we could say the dualism of the way that we are organized both economically and politically, right? What do I mean by that? Nation states, right? And they're separate. They think of themselves as separate. They're constantly jockeying. You know, we see this with the eco-agreements where every nation's jockeying to get other nations to do as much as possible where it won't have to do any more than it has to, kind of thing. But the irony of the ecological crisis is that it reveals the nation-state system is a construct that just isn't working anymore. When China burns coal, it doesn't just stay in its own skies, right? Where does it go? When Japan has a Fukushima nuclear accident, what does that mean for the water? They've just announced recently that they can't keep accumulating the radioactive water anymore. It's full. They have to dump it in the ocean. No one really knows what that means, but I guess we're all going to find out, right? So it's almost as if you could say the ecological crisis is a challenge to our whole civilization, our whole way of organizing and doing things. It's almost as if the Earth is telling us, wake up or get out of the way. Yeah. So that's the first iceberg. What's the second iceberg? Anybody?
Spiritual.
Jessica, is it?
Capitalism.
I'm sorry?
Capitalism.
That's certainly part of a big part of an iceberg, but I think it's still part of the first one. I actually kind of alluded to this in the very first sentence I said, but that was a long time ago, so. Anybody else?
The human's potential to wake up.
That's closer. Yeah, that's closer. I'm sorry?
A spiritual, I guess that's sort of the same.
Or let's be a little more specific.
Becoming conscious.
I'm sorry?
Becoming conscious.
You're all in the ballpark. The second iceberg that I want to talk about is Buddhism. And I call it an iceberg because I believe that our present situation is not only a crisis ecologically, it's also a crisis for our traditions. How we have been understanding and how we have been practicing them. To the point where I would say maybe part of the challenge today is that Buddhism needs to wake up, which is a little ironic given the meaning of the word Buddha, Buddhism, right? Awake. Maybe wake-upism needs to wake up. In order to fulfill best its liberated potential in the modern world. And the rest of what I want to say is about that. corresponding, so we have the one iceberg, climate emergency, ecological crisis, and then below, you know, a civilization that's lost its way with money and treating the natural world as a means and so forth. So corresponding to that, at the very top of the Buddhist iceberg, let's talk about eco-dharma, one of my favorite topics. Which is concerned to develop those aspects of Buddhist teachings that can help us understand and respond to the climate crisis, right? But this is kind of interesting. Eco-dharma is a term, you know, it's only in the last couple of years. The ecological crisis has been front page news since the 70s. And then I think, you know, we have Rachel Carson, and then we have James Hansen, his talk to the US Congress. There was the Earth Summit in Rio way back in 1992. Why has it taken Buddhism so long to start responding here? In fact, even last year, I had scheduled to present a number of workshops and talks on eco-dharma, and most of them were canceled or should have been canceled because very few people signed up. There was supposed to be a big Buddhist conference in Germany. I don't know, this is their big pan-Buddhist congress. I don't know if it's every year, every 2 years. The topic was Buddhism and the ecological crisis. I was going to be one of the speakers. It was canceled. Nobody signed up.
Wow.
They expected 400 people. No, they needed 400 to break even. They expected 500. When they canceled it a couple of months ahead, about 20 people had signed up.
Wow.
What's going on here? Indifference? Resistance? Actually, I think things are changing. In fact, I think there's been a real shift of consciousness just in the last year. And I'm not referring so much to Buddhism, but just in general. I don't know how much of it is the new IPCC report, right? Last year they told us we only have 12 years left to get really, really serious. Well, the IPCC is a very conservative organization. If they say 12 years, it's something more like 5 or 6. They continually understate how severe it is, right? I think people are more aware how severe it is. They're also more aware that governments are not responding and probably can't respond unless there are ways to put much more serious pressure. The reality is the governments are too much controlled, corrupted by wealthy and powerful corporations and people, right? And so the third thing is this new phenomenon, Extinction Rebellion. And Greta, and 350.org, and climate mobilization, and a lot of groups that are realizing, hey, our backs are against the wall. We don't have any time to waste. And so things are happening. But still, my original question remains. There's more interest now, finally, by Buddhism. But why has it taken us so long? What's going on? If eco-dharma is just the tip of the second iceberg, below that you could see eco-dharma is part of something that we might call social engagement, which is much broader, of course, right? But it's interesting that in the wake of the great financial recession, what is it, 2008, 2009, the two biggest, most important engaged Buddhist organizations, Buddhist Peace Fellowship and Zen Peacemakers, they both almost collapsed for lack of support, financial support. Fortunately, both survive in, you know, straitened circumstances, and they're doing the best that they can, doing a lot. But that's interesting. At the same time, Spirit Rock, this insight meditation center north of San Francisco, they had this multi-million dollar expansion. And evidently, they didn't have any trouble getting the money for that. Likewise, out on the East Coast, IMS, this other Vipassana meditation. They have this new long-term practitioners, millions and millions of dollars. No problem getting the money for that. But the money isn't available for social engagement. That's a challenge to us. What's going on here, guys? This doesn't mean that socially engaged Buddhism has failed. In fact, in some ways, I think it might have become a victim of its own success, in the sense that certain types of engagement, I think, are really now accepted as potentially important parts of the Buddhist path. I'm thinking of things like homeless kitchens, prison dharma. That's huge, right? Zen hospice, again. But notice that it's all about individuals helping other individuals. We've become a lot better, I think, helping to pull other drowning people, individuals, out of the water. But we're not much better at asking why there are so many more drowning people in the river. Who or what is pushing them in upstream? Why is it that the United States, the richest society in the history of the world, still has these kind of problems? We don't want to go there. Right? And in a way, I can understand that, because, you know, our practice, for the most part, is not about political analysis, right? I mean, Zen, for the most part, is non-intellectual, but sometimes we shade over into the anti-intellectual. And, you know, we don't want to think about the problem of institutionalized ignorance, institutionalized delusion, institutionalized greed, and so forth. That's harder for us to deal with. I'm reminded of Dom Helder Camara, the famous Brazilian archbishop. I think back in the 60s, he said, "When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why there are so many poor, they call me a communist." Is there a Buddhist version of that? When we do prison dharma and such, we're called bodhisattvas. But don't talk about institutional. Don't bring your lefty politics into Buddhism. Buddhism has nothing to do with that kind of thing, right? That has nothing to do with Buddhism, institutionalized dukkha. Okay, both of these forms of social engagement are still above the surface. But there's something much bigger going on. At the same time as there's a real problem with support for social engagement, there's something that Buddhism has spawned that has become really, really huge and growing very fast, and I'm sure somebody knows what I'm alluding to here. Mindfulness movement, right. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it. For the most part, I think it can be a very beneficial thing. But from a Buddhist perspective, too, there's tricky things to it, right? Especially insofar as certain types of meditation are kind of ripped out of their context, as if, hey, we've got the best of Buddhism and we can ignore all that superstitious stuff about enlightenment and all that, right? The problem with mindfulness is that it can discourage critical reflection on the institutional causes of collective suffering, or what I call social dukkha. Bhikkhu Bodhi put it very well, you know, making the point about Buddhism generally, when he said, "Absent a sharp social critique, Buddhist practices could easily be used to justify and stabilize the status quo, thus becoming a reinforcement of consumer capitalism." Is that what's happening to our traditions? In other words, Buddhism could be used to support the first iceberg. And to some degree, it is in certain types of mindfulness, right? Notice the contrast. Not much support for social engagement, eco-dharma, although I'm hopeful that's changing now. At the same time, this huge interest in mindfulness. What's going on here? Is there something that can help us understand this disparity? And I want to finish by talking a little bit about that. In particular, referring to a book I read some years ago by an academic named Loyal Rue. The title of the book is Everybody's Story, Wising Up to the History of Evolution. I think that's the subtitle. Anyway, I was reading this book and I came across a passage that literally stopped me in my tracks because it expressed so well my growing discomfort with certain types of Buddhism. He really seemed to put a finger on it, even though he wasn't singling out Buddhism, but he talked about religions like, including Buddhism, but also Christianity. And basically what he said is that, for example, Christianity and Buddhism, he believes, will both in the future become, will continue to decline as it becomes ever more apparent that they don't have what's needed to address the challenges we face today. He thinks that they're actually irrelevant or even a distraction from what we need to do today. And in particular, he cited two reasons for that, and that's what I want to talk about. The first reason, cosmological dualism. Don't worry, I'll explain it. And the second, individual salvation. Ooh. Mm-hmm. Cosmological dualism, the idea that there's kind of like two realities, say for Christianity, there's this world created by God, and then there's the higher world, God with heaven, and there's kind of a devaluation, therefore, of this world. This is kind of a place to qualify for an eternity with God in heaven. Who cares about this world? The idea is to pass the test and go to this better place, right? Right? We don't have anything like that in Buddhism, right? Well,
Enlightenment,
yeah, but let me first mention early Buddhism. If you think of the way that they talk about nirvana, and the whole point is not being reborn. So this world is the world of samsara, of suffering, craving, delusion, and the idea is to escape it by not being reborn. Well, that's about as dualistic as you can get. But as you were pointing about enlightenment, okay, we can feel superior. We're Zen students. We don't think that way. But how do we understand enlightenment? Or maybe to say it differently, how do we understand emptiness? You know, how do we understand what's going on in our practice? Maybe we're not transcending the world, but maybe in a way we are. We're finding this really quiet, peaceful place that's undisturbed, where we kind of feel indifferent, where there's no better and no worse, no gain, no loss. Does that involve a kind of duality that we can sort of separate ourselves? Of course, there's all kinds of other things going on in Buddhism. We can talk about Nagarjuna, right? His most great Buddhist philosopher who said, right? He basically denied any duality between samsara and nirvana. Different ways of experiencing this world. But still, in terms of our practice, I mean, we can point to other kinds of Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, where the idea is Amida Buddha is going to take us to his Western paradise. But even in Zen, again, I think we can see the whole path is about finding some place of emptiness or, you know, I'm not going to give you a teisho on emptiness, you'll be happy to know, but sort of conceiving of emptiness as something to be realized that is a kind of a salvation from all the hassles of this world, right? Do we sometimes think of it that way? Now, in the modern world, of course, there are a number of things in the modern world that are kind of consistent with Buddhism, but rather than going into that, one of them that definitely isn't consistent, or, you know, with Buddhism or Christianity, is the idea of a higher reality, right? And except for sort of multiverse speculations, we don't really, science doesn't seem to support that kind of idea. So, maybe it's not surprising that Buddhism in this country tends to be psychologized, become a kind of therapeutic. That is to say, it's not so much about transcending and escaping this world, but kind of fitting into it better. The real problem is the way my mind works. That's my traumas, my hassles, and through practice I can learn to let them go and fit into the world better, so I can be, right? I can be a better teacher, or a better husband, or a better father, or a better worker, right? The rough edges of my own mind are smoothed over, and I can kind of fit into any kind of situation, right? This is consistent with certain innovative types of psychotherapy. The emphasis is on psychological well-being and new practices that help to promote it. Sorting out our emotional lives, that's a big part of it, right? Working through our personal traumas. The basic presupposition to this is, again, the fundamental problem is the way that our minds work. And the solution is to change the way our minds work so that we can play our various roles better, so we can fit into the world better, right? Notice the pattern. On the one hand, earlier sort of more traditional Buddhism is about transcending or escaping this world. This more sort of psychologized Western Buddhism is about fitting into the world better. Opposites. And yet, what do they both agree on?
Preserving the status quo.
I'm sorry?
Preserving the status quo.
So, neither one of them challenges, neither one of them is engaged with what's happening socially, politically, ecologically. The one transcends it, the other kind of ignores it. Because the understanding is the real problem in my life, my own dukkha, is separate. It's just about my own mind, or we could say my own karma from my own past lifetimes and so forth. It's just about me. Neither one of them encourages engagement. And I think this has led to our own, I'm not saying this is the only thing, but this is one thing, right? I think this is connected with the Buddhist solution to the ecological crisis. Because I think we have a kind of special solution that we've worked out, right? What do I mean? Well, when I read the news and hear the latest horrible thing, the way things are breaking down more quickly than anyone anticipated. I'm trying to remember the latest, but too many. Okay, well, how do I feel? How do you feel when you come across this stuff? It's kind of discouraging, blah. We feel sad. We feel, you know, it's like, oh my God.
Numb.
Sorry?
Numb,
right? But hey, we're Buddhist practitioners. We know what to do when we have problematic feelings and thoughts, right? Let's go meditate. Let's go face the wall. Let's go meditate for half an hour or an hour, and we can let all that go. Get up. Question, is that our solution to the ecological crisis? Maybe not our conscious solution. Is that what we have been doing? Is that our way of evading the kinds of challenges we face today? Let me leave you with that question, just adding one more thing. I think all those ways of understanding our path are a real misunderstanding, a misconception about what the Buddhist path of transformation is really about. Thich Nhat Hanh put it very well when he said, we are here to overcome the illusion of our separation, right? The delusion of separation, the delusion of a separate self. And the challenge is to realize, one way to say it, to realize our sense of self, in fact, our sense of separation, and this therefore includes our whole way of understanding the world, it's a construct. It's a psychological, social construct. We've learned to experience ourselves and the world and other people in a certain way. And our path is about deconstructing and reconstructing this. Deconstruction is what's happening when we're meditating. The sense of self is composed of mostly habitual ways of thinking, feeling, acting, and so forth. When we're meditating, we're letting those go. As Dogen put it, we're in the process of forgetting ourselves so that ultimately we can wake up and realize our true nature. But that reconstruction, deconstruction, it also involves realizing, perceiving the world in a different way. And then as we feel, as we realize more and more, we're not separate from other people, we're not separate from the world, that my well-being isn't separate from your well-being, that also implies it's not just that we ourselves need to be deconstructed and reconstructed. What the ecological crisis is forcing us to realize is it's our society, it's the way that we're living together that needs to be reconstructed, right? Early Buddhism talks about greed, ill will, delusion as the three poisons or the three fires. We've institutionalized them. Our economic system has institutionalized greed. Our militarism and attitude toward immigrants, etc., institutionalized ill will. Fake news, but even more so, corporate media, they're not interested in educating or informing us. They want to grab our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder. It's all about advertising, making money, reinforcing consumerism. We have institutionalized the three poisons. And I think what the ecological crisis is really showing us, let's look at the deeper part of this iceberg, that we're now in a situation where we have to deconstruct and reconstruct and do what we can, not just for our own individual sake, but for the well-being of the whole. And I really feel as if the earth at this particular point in time is, as I said earlier, I think it's telling us to wake up or get out of the way. That's the challenge. And it's just as much a challenge for Buddhist practitioners as it is for anybody else. And the workshop that we'll have this afternoon will go a lot more into the various aspects of this. Okay?
Thank you.